Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Well, what happened to the Human Rights Program and the Center for the Study of Race and Law? Welcome to Minority Rights and State Accountability. Talk about being a dude. When the Center and the Human Rights Program began to think about how we might collaborate and create a year-long conversation in the law school on the nexus between civil rights and human rights, we knew we wanted to bring two things: fresh perspectives and critical interrogation of tough issues such as sovereignty, American exceptionalism, and social movement theory. We wanted to create a future series that showcased committed legal scholars and activists who wrote about, who labored in, and who sat on the front lines of real human dramas. The first thing that quickly emerged from my discussion was that of Jane Dewey. Her tireless advocacy and deep dedication to substantive equality and justice is unmatched. When the social justice community talks about Ms. McDougal, they use terms like dynamic, visionary, and moral force. To say the least, we are elated to have Ms. McDougal here today. As a child growing up in the Jim Crow era of Georgia, Ms. McDougal was heavily involved in civil rights activism, and she was chosen to be the first black student to desegregate Agnes Scott College in Decatur, Georgia. As Ms. McDougal became more active in the civil rights movement at home, her international perspective evolved, and she began to realize that the strategies adopted by African liberation movements could be applied in the domestic context. After graduating from Yale Law School, having worked for 2 years at a New York corporate law firm, she did something different. She dared to dream. Unlike many of my generation, Ms. McDougal saved her money during this time at a corporate law firm. And she worked for free, for 2 years as general counsel for the National Conference of Black Lawyers. There, McDougal became the group's representative to the United Nations and returned to her childhood passion, eventually developing an international task force on liberation movements in Africa. McDougal's work within the United Nations spawned her interest in human rights law, and she subsequently received her LLM in public international law from the London School of Economics and Political Science. Ms. McDougal's record of advocacy is extensive. In the 1980s, she directed the Southern Africa Project of the Washington-based Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. The project was founded to combat the 1967 Terrorism Act in South Africa that allowed police to detain political activists indefinitely without trial or legal representation. As apartheid crumbled, Ms. McDougal served as one of five international members of South Africa's 16-member independent electoral commission. There, she helped to organize and administer that country's first non-racial election. But even prior to the free elections in South Africa, she gave critical assistance to parties negotiating with the South African government for a transition to a post-apartheid democratic government by providing the negotiators analyses of comparing constitutional arrangements. In 1989, McDougal founded the Commission of Independence for Namibia, a bipartisan group of 31 distinguished Americans who monitored the 12-month process to independence mandated by the United Nations. The Commission successfully intervened to force modifications in critical legislation, such as voter registration and election laws, which, as drafted, threatened the fairness of the election process. In 1994, McDougal became the executive director of Global Rights, a human rights advocacy group that partners with local activists to challenge injustice and add new voices within the global discourse. At Global Rights, she did tremendous work, helping to develop and implement country and thematic programs in Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Americas. In 1998, she was elected to serve as an independent expert on the United Nations treaty body that oversees the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Ms. McDougal was the first American to be elected to the body of 18 international experts who oversee compliance by governments worldwide with the obligations established under the treaty. In 1996, the UN Commission on Human Rights elected her to serve a 4-year term as an alternate member of the UN Subcommittee on for the prevention of discrimination and protection of minorities of the Human Rights Commission. In that capacity, she also served as special rapporteur on the issue of systematic rape, sexual slavery, and slavery practices in armed conflict. She presented a groundbreaking study to the UN Subcommittee on Human Rights that called for international legal standards for prosecuting acts of systematic rape and sexual slavery committed during armed conflict. The report has been cited by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia as an authoritative statement of international criminal law in a landmark case involving sexual violence in a prison camp in Bosnia and Herzegovina. As special rapporteur, she also toured Sierra Leone with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to assess the devastating impact of civil war on the civilian population in Sierra Leone. In August 2005, Mr. Dugal was named the first United Nations independent expert on minority issues. In this role, her work complements and enhances other UN treaty bodies and mechanisms that address minority rights and minority issues, including the working group on minorities and the treaty monitoring bodies. I could go on, but professor at American University, McDougal is a legend in the field and a role model for social justice advocates. Again, we are elated to have her today as a distinguished figure in the global community. With no further delay, please welcome Gay McDougal, a freedom fighter, legal scholar, and journalist for justice.
Been a long life in an exciting way, but here we are, still working to make some difference, at least trying. As Tim said, I grew up in Georgia during the period of Jim Crow white supremacy segregation in the late 1940s. Throughout the 1950s. And so I have all my life identified as a member of a disadvantaged minority group. You know, I've got some real life experiences of living in a community that was trying to negotiate the terrain of racism. I got real life experiences of living in a community with its own gender distinctions while also living in a larger society where, you know, the standard was a sexist one. You know, I grew up in the apartheid south of this country. I was born into a community that was impoverished. It was a community of people who were just a few generations away from slavery. Yet, within that community, we had our own unique class distinctions. So, you know, this thing of the dualism of life as a minority in a larger society was something that kind of shaped my sensibilities and part of my skills. you know, to understand how a community operates when it is trying to manage the politics of having no power, but at the same time, trying to force power to you. These are the kinds of qualities, experiences, skill sets that minorities are trained to survive. We believed then in Georgia at that time, you know, in that place, that our situation was uniquely tragic. And I remember that we often look to the international community with the thought that somehow there was a world beyond this country that operated on different rules, that valued all kinds of people, that eschewed racism, and that simply wouldn't countenance inequalities. Well, we were both right and wrong. We were wrong in thinking that our situation was unique. You know, isolation can do that to you. And now that I've had an opportunity, I've grown up, I've learned a hell of a lot more. I've had unique opportunities to travel in all regions of the world. And, you know, now I can see that there are minority groups all over the world. In every region of the world, there are minorities that are living on the margins of their societies. They are all hungry. They are poor, brutalized, often by the police. They are excluded from politics. They are vilified in the media and are constantly pitted against each other. They are many. They're the dispossessed Aboriginal peoples of Australia. They are the Dalits in India. They are the nearly forgotten Pygmies in the Lake region in Central Africa. And the Western Shoshone in the southwest here have been put off of their land. And they're the Afro-Brazilians and the favelas in Rio and Sao Paulo. You know, they are the Hindus in Bangladesh, and they're the Muslims in India. They are the Kurds in Turkey, the Tibetans in China, the Palestinians, the Tamils in Sri Lanka. They are the Roma, which we call them Gypsies, throughout all of Europe. The indigenous peoples in Peru, the Mexicans in Texas, the ethnic Albanians in Serbia, and now they are the Serbs in Kosovo. When I look out, you know, across the world of minorities, I see women living at a very brutal intersection of race and gender and poverty. The Mexican women working in the industries along the Mexico-American border. The women in Southeast Asia that are trafficked into the sex trade into the Gulf countries. The undocumented migrants from Central America doing seasonal work in the harvest in the farms in Florida. They are the Haitians in the Dominican Republic. And they're the poor African American women who are trapped into sort of slave-like abusive working conditions in the catfish farming industries in Mississippi. Even last month, I was in Thailand for a conference of minorities from all over Southeast Asia. And I was really amazed at the number of minority groups that I was really hearing about for the first time. So, my point is that the segregated community that I came from in, you know, the 1950s in Georgia, we were wrong about being alone in the world. In fact, I have learned over the years that racism is ubiquitous. It's a global phenomenon. The victims may differ in language and culture, but the experiences of exclusions, coordination, violence, and discrimination are remarkably similar in every region of the world. So we were wrong about that. But we were right when we imagined that there was an international community that had different standards and rights and norms that existed then, and that, you know, were in the developmental stages. You know, I think few people actually realize the extent to which African Americans in this country have had a long history of appeals to the international community for racial justice over the years. It was all the way back to the anti-slavery movement. People like W.E.B. Du Bois, I hope this is a name that is known here, who was an African American and was by all accounts one of the most important sociologists of the 20th century. But W.E.B. Du Bois and other African-American leaders at that time participated very actively in the formation of the United Nations. And they testified before the Senate for ratification of the UN Charter because they envisioned a new world, not just a new United States, but it really was an envisioning of a new world in which there would be expanded rights of racial justice and new forms in which to plead those rights. And I really do mean an envisioning of a different world. You know, in 1947, if you stand in 1947 and you look back at history for me, a world that was where the vast majority of what are now countries in the world, you know, were all of the time either colonies of Europe or recently emerging from colonies. Most of the people in the world were colonies, you know, colonial subjects of Europe. You think about, you know, the biggest, some of the biggest countries in the world, like India, China. You know, these were peoples under subjugation. So, you know, the idea in 1947 of public policy, international public policy, built on the notion of every person being equal, was actually, you know, that was still a revolutionary thought. And so this is what was a part of the thinking of African American leaders of that time. So now what are these standards? What's evolved in terms of standards and norms of racial justice? And where are they evolved? When we talk about these standards of minority rights and racial justice, we're talking essentially about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which this is the 60th year of adoption, and seven core treaties. Things like the International Convention Against Racial Discrimination, the Convention on Discrimination Against Women, and Covenants on Economic and Political and civil and political, economic, social and cultural rights, conventions on migrant rights, the rights of the child, and also a couple of consensus-based declarations. The one that guides my work, the Declaration on the Rights of Persons Belonging to Racial and Ethnic, religious and linguistic minorities, and a brand new one, Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But, you know, in 1948, in the Universal Declaration, this body of law and what it was become, was to become, was called a common standard for all of humanity. That was 1948. Today, I would say that these conventions and declarations are the basis of addressing what I see as the 21st century issues of racism and minority race. And at the core are the twin principles of non-discrimination and equality. These are actually not the same. They're two twin, fraternal twins, not identical twins. But they are some of the oldest now, and considered at the highest level of customary international law. This is a legal and conceptual framework that recognizes both collective rights and individual rights that are important for personal identity, group identity. The framework establishes the obligations and duties of states to guarantee a life with dignity for everyone within its jurisdiction. Only very few distinctions there. It codifies benchmarks to be met by governments in meeting the rights of individuals. And it's not just the framework of restraints, government shall not. It very importantly includes affirmative obligations that governments have duties to take a number of steps to guarantee situations of equality and enabling environments for minority cultures to thrive. So, now while, as you may know, governments have to agree to be bound by treaties, once they do agree, they make two commitments, essentially. One is to change their laws and their policies and their practices so that they are fully in compliance with obligations under the treaties. To change their laws, their policies, and their practices. And the second major duty is to submit to international scrutiny, generally by a committee of independent experts from all over the world that monitor each country's compliance with the treaty on a periodic basis, country by country. There's also a system of special rapporteurs, which are high-level human rights investigators that are tasked with going to countries one by one and evaluating from the ground what's happening in terms of the policies and the practices, the obligations. This is now what I did. Three years ago, I was appointed to serve as the United Nations Independent Expert on Minority Issues, a special rapporteur. So I'm part of that system. Now, decades after I've left Georgia, I'm part of a system that is supposed to guarantee these rights on a global basis. And the key to this system of accountability, the key to making it work, is a seemingly irrational fact that most countries care about criticisms of their policies when they're made in international forums in front of other governments. I think it's irrational, but it's true. The more powerful the country, the more they seem to care. And so there's your sort of Achilles heel. I mean, most big countries have elaborate state departments and ministries of foreign affairs with lots of people who do nothing but focus on what's said about the country at the UN and other forums like that. And they're not tasked with trying to either avoid it or mitigate it or what have you. It is a system of shaming and blaming. That seems to have some successes. As some of you may know, the sort of pivotal case of Brown versus Board of Education, in that case, the United States submitted a brief to the Supreme Court, which had in it the text of a letter from the Secretary of State saying, in essence, that it would have great deleterious impact on the foreign policy of the United States if the Supreme Court upholds segregation in public schools. So this is something that matters to countries, and it's a system of accountability that's had its successes, and of course it's had a lot of failures. A success story. Well, I think the role that the international community played through the United Nations in the a struggle to end apartheid is a success story. That's actually when I first got involved in UN processes. So too the independence of Namibia. There have been some more recent ones, and there have been plenty of failures, which I won't. I don't think I need to. Actually, name for you, there's plenty around. You can turn on the evening news and they'll tell you all about it. This is a system of laws and accountability that for decades grew and developed in important ways outside of the participation of the U.S. government. Now, you know, we all know the story about Eleanor Roosevelt and, you know, being a part of the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and that's absolutely the case. But very shortly thereafter, the United States backed away from the system and for decades did not participate in the United Nations human rights mechanism. And it was, you know, there are a lot of reasons why. They're fascinating reasons that I think all of you should know about. And it's the subject of a totally different talk. And I just commend to you a phenomenal book written by Carol Anderson, Eyes Off the Prize. It's very, very excellent about what happened and why. But so for decades, the U.S. stood at arm's length of this very important developing system of human rights. Even today, the U.S. has only ratified a handful of these important conventions. Importantly, they have ratified the Race Convention and the Convention, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the genocide condition, et cetera. But there's still, you know, very poor laws of the U.S. and Africa. The United States is not, at this time, a member of the Human Rights Council, for example. And, you know, they routinely do things like after years of developing and, you know, discussion, et cetera, over the Declaration on Indigenous Rights, the U.S. votes against it. So, the U.S. is still an outlier in the system of accountability. But nevertheless, you know, to some important degree, the, you know, sort of dreams and envisionings of W.E.B. Du Bois many years ago have come true. We've got a system of, a body of laws, and we've got new arenas in which to seek enforcement of those laws. And, it has always disturbed me that by and large, U.S. civil rights lawyers, social justice advocates, et cetera, were largely absent from these forums. For over two decades, I have spent a tremendous percentage of my time traveling this country trying to persuade lawyers and advocates and community people who get involved in this system of rights and enforcement and UN forums. And at first there was great reluctance. I remember many introductions that I had gotten during that period that were far less kind than yours. And I must say that lawyers were the most reluctant to sort of even consider sort of retooling tactics. I think to some degree because we all got into the system of litigation as a singular way of enforcement rights, and you know, hoping we were going to get out of that system and a friendly judiciary, some specific relief for a specific client. And that anyway, the situation is so dire here, it was so overworked, we don't have time to switch focus, blah, 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 et cetera. But I'm really pleased and a little surprised myself now that the times have changed. The tide is turning. Last week, nearly 120 American lawyers, advocacy groups, and community activists actively participated in a hearing in Geneva, Switzerland, held by one of the UN treaty bodies, the one I used to sit on, serve the race, that oversees the race convention, where the UN committee questioned U.S. officials on race policies here in the U.S. And I mean, 120 you know, non-governmental activists go to Geneva, Switzerland, submit shadow briefs in hundreds of pages. This is a tremendous turnaround from 5 years ago when people were saying that, oh, well, you know, she's just a little bit, you know, there is a rising tide now of lawyers and judges and advocates in this country that are actively rebuilding our relations in the global movement for racial justice and international law. I mean, we're working to bring, and this is our mantra, we're working to bring human rights home. Because we see now that there are some real advantages, that this is that we can enter into a system where the law does provide broader rights, and this is law that's been agreed to by the majority of countries in the world, that there are treaty bodies that are constantly pumping out jurisprudence that enable these laws to continually evolve in terms of our understanding of how they impact on, you know, contemporary life and situations. We're doing it because we see that all this is having some influence on the U.S. courts, that over the past few years, there's been a significant docket of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court that have international law issues, human rights, humanitarian law, laws of war, as well as a whole range of other international legal issues that are now demanding the judiciary to say, oh, we're in the world too. Let's figure out how to look at treaties and what they have to do with us, and what does it mean when we ratify our treaties, and what does it mean for individuals in our countries. And, you know, people like Justices Ginsburg, O'Connor, Kennedy, you know, have retold some of these treaties and talked about their influences on them as they make their decisions in their opinions. So we see that we can be, have some influence when legislators are drafting new legislation or evaluating legislation comes before them. From local level, like San Francisco City Council, just adopting the whole body of the Convention on Discrimination Against Women as a city ordinance, and creating an internal operation to see to its implementation. From there, even if you will, to the federal level, where the U.S. Congress passes a law that Congress passed a law on torture based on international treaties. So we're seeing that we have some traction here. We're seeing that it's helping us separate what we used to call privileges and what is oddly, euphemistically called entitlements in this country. Entitlements means the opposite. You know, kindness, you ain't got none, but just give it, you have it, but we'll give you. The difference between that and a right. And we're seeing that this helps us identify who is responsible when lies fall apart. What are the responsibilities of governments when hurricanes, destroy age-old cities and turn people out and people of different means have different abilities to recuperate. We're saying there actually, this is not a void. We're operating in the context of some rules about that sort of thing. And we're saying that this can help us get authoritative interpretations about our situations here that come from international experts and recommendations from other governments about what the U.S. ought to be doing about the loss of housing by black people in places like New Orleans. And we're seeing that while we might be having trouble in a locality and with the local struggle like the Chilean Six, because Washington says, well, you know, that's the business of not only the state government says, oh, actually, that's the business of, cities, Board of Education, so we're down into this little hole that ain't nobody's business but our shuts. But when we raise it in Geneva, we've got an international committee of governments that ask, they don't ask the city council or Board of Education, they ask the U.S. State Department what the hell is happening in Geneva, and doesn't this violate this international treaty that you have pledged yourself to abide by. So last week in Geneva, when the Race Convention Treaty Fight served, questioned U.S. officials on compliance under the Race Convention, issue was joined on some of these following points. The limited way we define racial discrimination in the United States. This is a very central point for the rest of the world. The Race Convention says that racial discrimination is any distinction based on race, etc., which has the purpose or the effect of impairing the enjoyment of rights. The purpose or the effect. Now, in this country, it's constitutional law, the purpose part. And the U.S. government responds, well, that's nice, but, we've got Title VI and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. We've got the Federal Voting Rights Act. And that covers the question of effects. If you're under those statutes, you don't have to prove effects. But, the rest of the issues where you might find a situation where there's a pattern, a clear pattern of racial injustice, but you just can't prove who intended it to be there, or in the United States, that's not actionable. And the international community says, sorry, that's not good enough. They question the U.S. on issues of how this government is treating non-citizens. The United States says, well, non-citizens, we actually don't have any obligations at all with respect to how we treat non-citizens. And certainly, non-discrimination, that doesn't attach to non-citizens. And it's a national community. So it said, excuse me, I think you're wrong there. And you can just look at the issues that we've been dealing with in this country over the last several issues, from the questions of whether the kid of an illegal, of someone without documents can go to kindergarten, you know, to the question of whether or not you can torture an alien. You know, we have problems with the question of non-citizens. But international law is a comprehensive system. And it's saying right now to the U.S. government, it just can't do that. They question the, they criticize the disproportionately high percentage of minorities in jails and prisons, and consider that maybe it's not only a question of failure of the right to equal treatment before the law. Maybe this is also a violation of the responsibility of government to see that there is no discrimination in socioeconomic opportunities for minorities. Now, of course, the U.S. answered, well, that's interesting, but first of all, we don't think that economic, social, and cultural rights are rights. And secondly, we think that the reality is that minorities do more crimes. Shall I read? it says disparities in the incarceration rates are related primarily to differential involvement in crime by various groups. I think that is minorities do one crime. And also, differences related to drug use and enforcement, I suppose. The U.S. was criticized on the death penalty, particularly in southern states where racial disparities are unmistakable, and called for a moratorium on executions. They were criticized on felon disenfranchisement laws, criticized as those for violating the treaty guarantee against racially discriminatory voting laws. They were criticized for disparities in enjoyment of economic, social, and cultural rights, particularly with housing, education, employment, healthcare. Of course, there was a substantial disagreement on affirmative action. You can imagine the discussion on that, particularly since the CERD treaty body believes that affirmative action is an obligation on states. And the United States, of course, takes quite a different view. They were criticized because of unilateral abrogation of Indian treaties, where the U.S. is putting up land for sale belonging to a number of indigenous communities in this country. Violence and abuse against women belonging to racial, ethnic, national minorities, particularly Native American, Alaska Native American women. Racial disparities in the field of sexual and reproductive rights, particularly with respect to African American women, and they talked about the disparities in HIV infection rates for minority women. On and on. I mean, they know what they're talking about. It's not general. So, you know, this is a system that is mature. And we have to be there. By the way, I mean, imagine what it would be like if the courts of this country, like those of South Africa, recognize human rights to health care and at the highest level of potential for everybody. 45 million Americans. So, you know, we've got an election now pending to some degree on whether or not 45 million people in the richest nation in the world are going to be able to have basic health care. What if it were right? What if we could make the right to education and the race convention? Again, the U.S. has ratified this. Means that every child in this country, white, black, rich, poor, is entitled to equal, quality, public education, regardless of any district line between rich suburbs and, you know, poor inner cities. What if we could enforce an international covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights to mean that all those people that are being displaced in New Orleans, in fact, I've just written a letter in my capacity, human capacity, to the U.S. government about the demolition of public housing in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans at the time when public housing is most needed. They're demolishing the housing with, of course, disparate impact on minority groups. I mean, this sounds like a fantasy to some people, but it's not truly unrealistic. Remember 1947? You know, when most of the world was out of Europe, things changed. And remember 5 years ago when I couldn't get anybody to listen to this stuff, and now it's 120 of our colleagues, so they're fighting the good battle. Things change. I think we've got to take advantage now of it and make sure that it changes in a way that benefits our issues. And for those of us who use law in the service of community organizing, use law to make change on the ground, I think it's really important that using an international human rights framework is very empowering for people at the community level. I had a lot of trouble convincing lawyers. I had no trouble convincing community level activists. They got it right away. Because it creates such a sense of empowerment and momentum. It means that international law and international community thinks you're right. And for poor communities struggling in isolation, that's a winner. You know, it also is very important in helping communities have a broader line of vision. You know, you look at it, and then you look up and you see, as I did after leaving Jordan, that there are other things happening out there. And one of the things that, you know, we miss in this country is the understanding of how local barriers and power structures are really driven by dynamics at the global level. In today's world, societal problems like racism and poverty are complicated things. Globalization has created a world in which we are inextricably linked to things that are happening in different, on the other side of the globe. You know, our fortunes, if we have any, are linked to that, but so are societal problems. So it's really impossible, I think, to find a real solution to a problem like racial discrimination and poverty in one country without a reference to the global context in which it arises. I just can't really see how you can tackle racial discrimination in the 21st century without tackling the reality of the global economy. I mean, increasingly, the critical issues that are, you know, determining the daily realities of our lives are being made in some great degree in places places in, you know, far away from here, the WTO and the IMF, at the Davos summit. You know, those are places where they are making some decisions that will impact on whether or not we have jobs, what it is, what sector those jobs are in, how much we pay for a t-shirt, or a cotton dress, or a loaf of bread. These are battles that I just don't believe can be won by activism solely within the national boundaries of anybody's own country. I mean, when we talk about institutional racism today, well, the institutions we're talking about are so massive that they span national borders and they defy anybody's ideas of jurisdictional limits. You cannot address them with any one country's civil rights laws. So I firmly believe that isolation can doom us. We must begin to understand and to frame our issues that are here on the ground, our domestic issues, using the language and using the systems of the international community in order to really fashion real solutions, but also, importantly, to gain allies that we need in other places in the world that will join us in a struggle around similar issues, often against the border institutions. So that is my message, I am very appreciative of the kind of interest that I find here at UVA, especially in the law school, about these issues. I've known people here, certainly have known Adina and the work that she's been doing here. I know UVA graduates and have worked with them, and I think that, you know, there is an echo of the message that I think is important is also coming out of here. And I congratulate and commend you on that, and I offer my assistance to help you go to the next mile.